Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Venture anything. Jeanette Barnes brings you insights from people behind the news and people like you. Now, venture anything.
Hello, we're speaking today with Eric Stevens, Chief Development Officer at Vineyard Wind. Welcome, Eric.
Hello, good to be here.
Talk a little bit, just to introduce people who may not be familiar with your project, about the turbines and where they're going. Is it, it's correct that it's up to 100 turbines, possibly, depending on how large they are?
Right. It'll probably end up being something less than 100 turbines, because the turbines that we're looking at now are larger than 8 megawatts, and it will be an 800 megawatt project, so something less than 100 turbines. And they'd be located about 14, the closest turbine would be located about 14 miles from either Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, and that puts about 30 miles south of the Cape.
I've read that the maximum size of the turbines is somewhere around 10, 11 megawatts. Is that, what are you actually looking at?
The maximum size now is that we're permitting is about 10 megawatts.
Okay.
So for this project that we're permitting right in the process of permitting right now, would be something about 10 megawatts. But the technology is changing very quickly, and you know, with each new project, the turbines are getting bigger.
Yeah, actually, when I tried to do some little internet research on that, it was like every story I looked at had a different number for what was the maximum. So it does seem like it's a moving target.
Right.
And will people on either the Cape or the islands be able to see the turbines from land?
From the Cape, no. From Nantucket and the Vineyard, there are points where you could see them. We've done photo simulations, and those are available out on Nantucket and the Vineyard for people to stop by and see them if they didn't get to one of our open house events where we presented them. The photo simulations, by the way, are they're printed out on a large format to really give the full sense of the what it would actually be like in real life. But you can see them at times. Obviously, it's very weather dependent. Most of the times here in New England, you can't see more than 14 miles anyway. You know, given either the summer haze or fog and whatnot. But on a clear day, you can see the tops of the turbines in the distance from certain locations anyway.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about what. What's the latest on, you know, what you're doing now in terms of maybe surveying or what permits and all that?
Yeah, so we're doing a number of surveys offshore right now. The one is the doing more geological survey, and what that means is using sonar-type technology to measure the water depth and also to be able to model the ground conditions beneath the seafloor, so whether there's rocks in the area, the density of the soil, and that kind of thing. And we're doing that along the cable route, with the proposed cable route, but also in the area where the turbines would go. And then the other thing we're doing is what's called geotechnical survey, which means actually using a probe or a small drill kind of setup to actually get samples of the soil of the seabed and bring it up to be able to study it, actually physically analyze the material that's there. And then the other thing we're doing is video surveys, and that's more for looking at different habitat types, whether it's what different shellfish might be there, whelk and that sort of thing. Eelgrass is something we're looking for. And then the other final one might be what's called benthic grabs, which is basically kind of a small clamshell device that scientists use to get a sample of the top layer of the seabed where clams and other shellfish and other organisms live that you couldn't see from a video survey, to be able to characterize the infauna, as it's called, that actually burrow into the ground. So to get a sense of the, are there any unexpected species, and what's the abundance of species in particular areas and things like that.
Obviously, some of those animals that are living in the seabed would have to be displaced when you put in foundations, right?
Right. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. But we're talking about things like surf clams, whelk, things that are harvested in terms of the sub-bottom animals, and then the other survey that's been completed already was doing a final check for lease terns in the area.
Oh, okay.
In the spring, we did that earlier in the spring when you'd expect to see them if they were there. And basically, we confirmed what previous studies had been telling us, that there really isn't a lot this far offshore, because terns are a shore bird, and we're actually pretty far offshore. So the question was whether they'd be where they would be in their migration pattern. It seems like that's not an area that they use from the studies we've done.
Okay. Do you have any news to share with us today about your contractors, who's going to be doing being the major suppliers?
No, unfortunately not yet. We're our strategy on that is to keep the competition among the different suppliers going up until the very last moment. That's what it's a lot of large projects will do, because it gets them gets you the better prices, and really encourages people to think about innovative solutions, about different problems, different ways of doing the job that can save money. So we're actually trying to keep that competition going as long as we can.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the other day at the supply chain forum, your CEO talked a little bit about the three tiers of supply, mm-hmm. right? And he was saying, at least afterward with the reporters, that a lot of the tier one suppliers, so the people who are actually bidding in directly to you for the big items, mm-hmm. the big responsibility, that those are likely to be coming from Europe, right? Because they have the experience. So,
right.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how local contractors could fit into that?
Right. It's, and I would say it isn't even so much that they're European companies. It's just that there's a few companies in the world that can do these very specialized fabrications and manufacturing. I mean, there's only three offshore wind turbine manufacturers in the whole world, so it's not, and they do happen to be from Europe. So it's not that it's the issue isn't so much European. It's just that there's few of them. So. So given that, especially here in the U.S. where, ours is the first large-scale project, you can't really expect that those few large companies would have much operation here in the U.S. yet. But as with any manufacturing or fabrication, the main large company that actually has their nameplate on the turbine, say, is turning around and hiring hundreds of other different companies to supply parts, supply materials, do subcontracting, and so on. So, if you think about building a car, for example, really what is, say, GM doing is they're buying parts from all different other suppliers and putting them together and then putting their name on it. So if you think about it that way, most of the jobs actually aren't, not only they're not with us as the contractor, they're not actually even with the tier one company, if you want to call it that. They're actually with the people who supply the materials, supply the subcomponents, who are subcontracted to put them together. And so actually where there's the most opportunity for local companies actually is the area where there's the most jobs for that reason. And so really what we're trying to encourage is for local companies who have skills or experience that are translatable to offshore wind, to, you know, this, that actually is a great opportunity because, you know, just for example, there's a lot of welding that goes on, and while knowing how to weld an offshore wind tower, say, is a specific thing that will have a large tier one name brand on it, at the end of the day, welding is welding. And so there's a lot of opportunities for multiple companies, for example, to actually be contracted to do the welding, as an example. And so on down with, you know, all the supplies and everything else that's needed to build the project.
Okay. And we're still looking at possibly the end of 2019 for construction to start?
Yep. Yeah. The end of 2019 and the actual on-site construction would probably start, you know, very early in the next, in the 2020.
Okay. So the power comes on shore by cable. And then can you just give us a really quick review for listeners who might not know, how does that actually get to your house?
So starting with the turbine area 14 miles offshore, each of the turbines is linked with a cable, a medium voltage cable, similar voltage to what runs up and down all of our streets that you see overhead in your neighborhood. And they're sort of connected kind of like lights on a Christmas string light. And they go into an offshore substation. All these, it'll be maybe, you know, 8 or 10 strings, say, of these different turbines. They go into the offshore substation. The voltage is stepped up to a higher transmission level voltage that's used for transmitting power over long distances. And then there'll be two cables to bring the power from the offshore substation, buried under the seabed and then buried under the roads of either Yarmouth or Barnstable, to the substation. That we'll be building, which is adjacent to an existing substation owned by the utility out there. And then what we'll be doing is the equipment that we put in will make that final connection to the existing New England grid. And from there, once it's on the New England grid, the energy goes throughout New England just the way any other generation plant puts its energy onto the grid, and then there's an accounting for that to bring the benefit of that, the commercial aspect of it is done through basically an accounting mechanism with the utilities, and then the other aspect of it is because we're connecting where we are, even though the energy goes throughout New England. Wherever it might be applied commercially, the fact that you're making that connection there on Cape Cod actually can help enhance reliability in the area of Cape Cod, because it's where we're connecting is actually at the very edge or the end of the line, if you will, of the high voltage transmission system. And even without being an electrical engineer, which I'm not either, you can sort of intuit that, if you're drawing on electricity from the very end of the line, there'll be times when there's a lot of demand, say, where you can't get the energy out to the very end of the line when you need it most, that can, provide challenges to the grid system generally. And so by us providing power at the very edge there, it actually makes the grid in the area of Cape Cod more robust and stronger. So for example, last winter, there was a big storm. One of the power lines near the Plymouth nuclear plant came down because of ice or wind. There was backups in place, so there was no issue. But if those backups in turn had failed, it would have been a problem for the Cape region, the potential for a blackout. And so having large amounts of power from an offshore wind farm injected or provided into the grid in that area would have helped in those kind of situations, and just make the grid more robust and stronger and better, more resilient, better able to withstand things like ice storms and so on, or particularly high usage periods.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the job training part. That's something that I know a lot of our readers have been interested in. When you were still in the competition stage with the other two companies, everyone was pledging, you know, funding for training, and it seemed like the other two bidders had a more specific outline that they revealed publicly of, you know, what college they were partnering with and what they were going to do. They were one was going to endow a professor and things like that. Mm-hmm. Your statement, you pledged money, but what you were going to do was much more general. Is mm-hmm. there anything you can tell us now about, you know, schools you might be working with or anything?
Yes, the reason it was general wasn't because we didn't want to make specific commitments. It was really that we thought everybody would be better served by having, you know, an inclusive conversation about, you know, what's the best way to roll out a program across the region that works for everyone. And so, you know, what we said we would do and what we will be doing very soon, we actually have a first meeting next week to start planning this, is you know, bringing together all these different colleges and schools. So whether it's the Votech school out in Martha's Vineyard, or, you know, Cape Cod Community College, and you know, BCC here in New Bedford, and bringing everyone together and figuring out what's the best way to put together a comprehensive regional program or strategy so that we can, you know, make best use of the resources that we have already, and also make sure that you know, the workforce gets the training it needs, and then also you know, that it works for everybody, whether you're in New Bedford or out in the Vineyard or out on the Cape, and also that it's setting a foundation for an ongoing program and something that can grow as the industry grows. We're really seeing this as a long-term effort, and you know, we think it's more valuable to put in place sort of fundamentals and structures that can be grown and scaled up as the industry grows, rather than just sort of quickly making decisions about a particular class or something like that. And so we didn't, you know, we're not the experts in workforce training, so we wanted to have the flexibility and opportunity to meet with those experts and together and decide on what's best for the region.
Has it been tough for you at all to try to balance kind of the interests of the New Bedford area versus Cape and Islands? Because, you know, with the other companies, everyone had committed to, you know, stage installation out of New Bedford, but the others did not also have that commitment to the Cape and Islands to do things out there. So is that difficult?
No, I wouldn't say it's difficult, but it's just, you know, something that we need to work towards. But I think our project does sort of span the Cape and Islands and South Coast geography more than some of the other projects did. So, you know, we're looking at O&M out on Martha's Vineyard. Our cables are coming ashore on the Cape, and we'll be building the project mostly based out of New Bedford, and we're looking really hard at Brayton Point as well. But I think everybody we've met with understands that everything doesn't happen in one place, you know, that depending on whether just geography and you know, what infrastructure is in a location, you know, everybody seems to understand that, you know, this is a large project with a lot of diverse elements, and different areas will have different roles. You know, I think a lot of people are interested in the economic development aspect of it. And that's why we're trying to be really thoughtful and deliberate about how we roll out a workforce program to make sure that opportunity is available to everyone.
So. Okay. Thanks for coming in. Is there anything else you wanted to share before we go?
No, I mean, we're very excited to have been selected, and we're continuing our hard work, and look forward to continuing meetings with folks in the different towns where our project will be, and we're excited to be doing this.
Okay, thank you so much, Eric Stevens from Vineyard Wind.
Thank you.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.